I think this is the third time that I've come to visit your community, and I can just tell by all the announcements that this is a really vital sangha. It's wonderful. It's really, you're so fortunate to have each other. In a world where greed, hatred, and delusion are so often dominant forces in this world, it is really wonderful to have a community of people who are seeking to reduce those forces in their lives and supporting each other to do that. So it's just a delight to open my eyes and look out and see so many people gathered here. So thank you for having me. I'd like actually to talk about the subject of wisdom tonight. A little louder? Okay, good. Raise your hand again if I'm not projecting enough. I'd like to talk about the subject of wisdom tonight. And what has sort of impelled me to give this talk is that it actually has a little bit of disturbing information in it. But I have felt actually as the Dharma has deepened and as people deepen their practice more and more over these decades since Vipassana has really come here from Asia, it feels important for people to have full information about the development of wisdom, including some of the difficult information. So that's my motivation. I've actually found people who are confused about what's happening to them in their practice because they don't have the context of information. The word for wisdom in Pali is panya. And an easy way to define what it is it's simply knowing what is true and knowing what is not true. And it's just that shift in perspective that frees us. You know, this practice is really about liberation. And the Buddha defined liberation as the elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion from our minds and hearts. And as wisdom deepens for us, it helps to reduce first greed, hatred, and delusion and all of their cousins. And the Buddha said that eventually it will uproot those qualities from our hearts forever. That there are a successive series of insights that deepen wisdom as we do this practice. Just to bring it down to the basic teachings, this will be very familiar information, familiar concepts, but the core teachings of the Buddha are the Four Noble Truths. It was his very first talk. And over 45 years, he gave 84,000 other talks, which were simply elaborations on that first talk. And in that talk, he said that there is suffering in the world, that the cause of suffering is essentially our grasping at and trying to hold on to cling to pleasant experience, and our resistance to and trying to get rid of and trying to keep away unpleasant experience. That's the second truth. The third truth is he said that there can be a cessation of suffering, an ending of suffering, when we stop grasping at and clinging to pleasant experience and we stop resisting unpleasant experience. And he said that there is a way to the end of suffering that is essentially our practice, the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. He said if you really want to be free, deeply cultivate these eight things. Right understanding, which is wisdom. Right intention. Right speech. Right action. Right livelihood. Right effort. Right mindfulness and right concentration. And the Buddha basically taught a progressive path. You know, that when he taught people, he tended first to teach them about cultivating generosity in their lives. And then cultivating ethical conduct, the three aspects of the Eightfold Path of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. What we say, what we do, and how we make our living in the world are the aspects of the manifestation in the world of that part of our practice, of non-harming conduct, of making an effort not to harm, but to help through those expressions in our lives. He said that it is really necessary to have a founding in generosity and ethical conduct to purify our speech and our action and the way we work, to come to some purification of those things in order to develop strong concentration through meditative practice. He said that if you're habitually harming in your life, then your mind is too agitated actually to tranquilize it, to bring it to calm and stability of a concentrated mind, a one-pointed mind. So he said that ethical conduct is necessary in order for concentration to exist through through meditative practice. Once concentration is well established, then wisdom arises. So the meditative aspects of the Eightfold Path are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Concentration, the eighth aspect of the Eightfold Path, is necessary. It's the necessary precondition for wisdom to arise, the first aspect of the Eightfold Path. So you see how it all works together? The Buddha described it this way in terms of the way these things interact with each other. He said, concentration suffused with ethical conduct becomes very fruitful. Wisdom suffused with concentration becomes very fruitful. The mind suffused with wisdom is liberated. And then in another place he says, beings have to travel through this long round of rebirths because they have not penetrated four things: a noble one's virtue, that is ethical conduct; a noble one's concentration; a noble one's wisdom; and a noble one's deliverance. So if you have some sense about how these aspects of the Eightfold Path all reinforce each other. As wisdom deepens, we come to understand more and more deeply the Four Noble Truths themselves, very subtle and very deep, each one, each aspect of the Four Noble Truths. As wisdom deepens, we come to understand more and more the law of karma, the fact that everything arises because of a cause. As wisdom deepens, we come to understand more and more what the Buddha called the three universal characteristics of all phenomena: the fact that everything is impermanent, the fact that everything is unsatisfactory because it's impermanent, it's unstable, insecure, unreliable, and the fact that everything is not self. We come to understand these three things more and more deeply. The great Tibetan teacher Kalu Rinpoche, not the current one, but the one who died in 1989, you know these Tibetan lamas keep reappearing. Kalu Rinpoche once described the deepening of wisdom, I think, in an extraordinarily beautiful way with a little poem. He said, "We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you know that you are nothing. And being nothing, you are everything. That is all." That for the most people, through most of our lives, we live in illusion. We don't understand what is true. We believe to be true things that are not true. It perpetuates our suffering. For example, we believe that the source of our happiness is grasping at and clinging to what is pleasant and resisting what is unpleasant. We believe we can somehow come to happiness that way. We don't understand that it doesn't work and in fact leads to our suffering. We live in that illusion. We live through these appearances. Once we penetrate that illusion, we come to see that there is indeed a reality, a truth, that we are that reality. And once we understand this, we know that we are nothing, and being nothing, we are everything, that is all. when we come to see that there is no separate self here. There's a lot of happiness that comes from wisdom. The Buddha described various kinds of happiness. He said there's the happiness of sense pleasures. We all know that. Good food, good music, good smells, good physical sensations, good thoughts, good feelings, emotions. And he described deeper forms of, and more and purer forms of happiness, like the happiness of a concentrated mind, for example, or the happiness of equanimity. In some ways, wisdom brings us the supreme happiness, the greatest form of happiness. I think we've all had that experience of aha, of just that insight of coming to understand something in a deep intuitive way. I'm sure we've all had that experience. You know, I'm sure you've heard about Archimedes running naked through the streets of whatever the city was, Syracuse, in the ancient Greek world, because he had discovered something, a deep scientific truth in the bath. His body had displaced water and he understood something. That eureka is the experience of wisdom, of insight. That deepening sense of aha, which is really what insight meditation is about, a succession of insights brings deeper and deeper forms of happiness. And the Buddha said that really the only happiness that is greater than that is the happiness of nirvana, of experiencing unconditioned reality. And wisdom brings us to that as well. This is the Buddha on nirvana. He said, it is profound, peaceful, free from all troubles, luminous, and uncreated, like an elixir of immortality. And at one point he says, bliss, yes, bliss, my friends, is nirvana. And Edward Conci, in his book Buddhism, says, nirvana is permanent, stable, imperishable, immovable, ageless, deathless, unborn, and unbecome. It is power, bliss, and happiness, the secure refuge, the shelter, and the place of unassailable safety. It is the real truth and supreme reality. It is the good and supreme goal and the one and only consummation of our life, the eternal, hidden, and incomprehensible peace. Imagine coming to unassailable safety. Wisdom takes us there. But before we can come to that unassailable safety, and here's the bad news. That bliss, that happiness, that secure refuge, we have to pass through some insecurity, some fear, and some helplessness, actually. There's a way in which we have to, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, we have to pass through suffering in order to come to the cessation of suffering. And wisdom takes us through that difficult passage. In every spiritual journey, there's a descent. I've just been rereading Dante. I just turned 56 a few months ago, and Dante died at 56, and I've been rereading him just as a way of sort of honoring one of my heroes as I pass beyond where he lived. And the beginning of his great poem, it's just every person in Italy can recite these words. My Italian's lousy, but I just want to give you the first stanza of the Divine Comedy. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Halfway through the journey of this life, I found myself in a dark wood where the true way had been lost. And this is what Dante's great story, the great journey of Dante's description, is that he has to go through the darkness and the suffering and the difficulty and the pain of the Inferno before he can start going up through Purgatorio to Paradiso. His story, Dante's version of deliverance, has much more to do with love than with wisdom. And they're really two aspects of the same thing. But it's the story of the descent, appears in all the great spiritual traditions. Before the bliss of nirvana, there's a way in which wisdom actually assaults and deconstructs our conventional minds and destroys our world. Chogyam Trungpa, the great Tibetan teacher, said, "Practice is insult after insult." And the great Advaita Vedanta teacher said at one point, "The search for reality is the most dangerous undertaking because it destroys the world you know." There's some way in which our understanding of the world has to be deconstructed and destroyed before we can have a new vision of how things actually are. And that's not an easy process. You know, it's so easy to say the search for reality is the most dangerous undertaking because it destroys the world you know. It's quite poetic, isn't it? But to actually go through that is not so easy. So there's a very traditional kind of description of the progress of insight in this Theravada Buddhist tradition. It's described most completely in the classic text of the 5th century of this common era by Buddhaghosa. It's called the Visuddhimagga, or the Path of Purification. It's a very complete text, and it's almost unreadable. In the 20th century, there were some good summaries of the Visuddhimagga. Mahasi Sayadaw, the great Burmese teacher who was my spiritual grandfather, wrote a book called The Progress of Insight, which sums it up. Daniel Goleman's very first book many years ago was called The Buddha on Meditation and Altered States of Consciousness, which is still available through the Buddhist Publication Society. And Matt Flickstein actually has come out with a book quite recently called Swallowing the River Ganges, which sums up the Visuddhimagga in a readable form for contemporary people. Just mentioning this, just to let you know that the information is available. And that progress of insight actually takes us through far greater happiness and joy than we normally experience. It's almost as if we allow ourselves a very narrow range of experience in our lives, in our conventional way of living. And what happens when we practice the Dharma long enough is that we actually come to experience tremendous rapture, incredible bliss, beautiful tranquility, wonderful equanimity, lots of light and sense of boundlessness, of being at one with the universe, all this good stuff. But it's also true that if we do enough practice, we also open to the suffering that we do not allow ourselves to experience, which is in our psyches, but is blocked by our denial system. And we also open to universal suffering. And it can be hard. A wonderful talk that Jack Engler, who's a research psychologist at Harvard and also a Vipassana teacher, he gave a beautiful speech in long ago now, in 1989, at the Harmonia Mundi conference, where he said that basically the progress of insight follows the classic stages of loss and mourning. First, the stage of denial, and then the stage of what he calls disorganization, which is resistance and anguish. And then finally, the stage of acceptance of reality, of coming to terms with reality. Wisdom destroys the world we know, and it can be an earth-shattering experience. And I think people should know that along the spiritual path. It takes a certain amount of courage, and it actually is important to know this, because it's a transit that we make, but it does have an end. What we do as we do the practice is that we build great strength of mind through developing, if you know any of the lists of this tradition, the 7 factors of enlightenment, or the 5 controlling factors, or the 10 paramis, or perfections of a Buddha. We build these powerful, wholesome states of consciousness that become stronger and stronger, so that we can begin to actually experience more and more deeply the challenges of the path, as well as the joys of the path. And what happens is that we come actually to experience impermanence. We actually come to see the momentary arising and passing of many things very quickly. And as the mind becomes very powerful, and mindfulness becomes very strong, and concentration is very strong, we come to actually undermine, in a sense, the way we construct the world. And this happens in an event in consciousness that happens in milliseconds. Jack Engler describes this. That an event happens like a sound, you know, the sound of the bell. An event happens, it's heard in consciousness, and within milliseconds, perception will come, which is a kind of recognition, oh, there's the bell. You know, the perception comes, a concept of bell, and it's through that perception that we actually come to construct a world that feels stable and continuous. As mindfulness becomes strong enough, it actually catches events before the perception happens. And when that starts to happen, the world feels as if it has become extraordinarily momentary. It's much more unstable. We see the momentary arising and passing of things. We see through the illusion of permanency, of solidity, of continuity. Nothing solid or stable is out there or in here, we come to see. All of the security that we've constructed in our lives begins to fall apart. Nothing seems secure or reliable. There's nothing to depend or rely on when we begin to see the momentary impermanence of all things. When that happens, and the mind has to be very powerful in order for this to happen, we feel as if the world is out of control, actually out of our control, which is our reality, actually. It feels as if there isn't anywhere to turn. There's nowhere to get the usual comfort. When I was experiencing this in practice, to me the comfort has always come from being out in the natural world. And I remember I was at Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, and I went for a walk in the forest to get comfort from, I had trained the chickadees to come and feed from my hand, and I went out there for comfort, and it just wasn't there. You come to actually experience the universe being created and then being destroyed moment by moment. It feels discontinuous. It arises, it passes, it arises, it passes. There's no longer a sense of continuity. So there's a sense of everything vanishing in a moment of dissolution. And the response can often be, although it isn't always, the response can often be grief, sorrow, rage, terror, despair, restlessness, apathy, withdrawal, disgust, a wish to be done with it all, and misery. Doesn't that sound like fun? And we really come to see, through this triggering of the impermanence of things, we really come to see impermanence and the unsatisfactoriness of all things because they're impermanent, and the fact that there is no self. There isn't enough continuity for there to be a continuous self. And so there's a kind of struggle. And it's different for different people. I just led this retreat at Spirit Rock that ended yesterday, and I was talking to one of my colleagues who was co-teaching with me, and we were talking about this stage of practice, which is called the stage of terror, or it's called rolling up the mat, because most people are ready to stop practice at this point in practice. And she said, you know, I didn't have any fear when I went through that. Everything was dissolving all around me. Even the ground didn't seem to be holding me up. But it wasn't fearful. And I thought, gee, you know, I felt envy, actually. But then what happens is the next stage, which is a stage of surrender. You know, it's just like the stages of mourning or grief. There's finally the stage where we say, well, so be it. If this is the way things are, then we stop resisting it. And the mind goes into a very sweet, stable place of deep equanimity, of deep acceptance, and an equanimity that becomes more and more firmly established so that the mind is not wavering any longer. It's no longer reaching for what is pleasant. It's no longer resisting what is unpleasant. In the deep stages of equanimity, the mind becomes like a diamond mountain, a mountain of diamond. It's luminous, it's brilliant, and it's very, very stable. And it's at that point that the heart then turns toward nirvana, and it's out of equanimity that the mind opens to nirvana. So it's just I think the reason that I share this information that wasn't shared by my teachers, actually, and so when I got into this stage of practice where things became very challenging for me, where everything seemed to be dissolving, where the world I knew was being destroyed and the world that was coming hadn't yet established itself, nobody said to me, well, you know, this is just a stage of practice and you'll come through it. So just keep going. These are the times when we need to buoy each other up and support each other. And it's very important to have a teacher to support us through it. And the reason I'm sharing all this information is that I'm running into lots of people whose practice is really getting deep now. And this stage of practice is coming up for them and they don't have a clue. They think they've gone into severe depression. And it's not depression at all. It's really opening to universal conditions, not to personal conditions. So this has been a serious enough talk that I would like to end with a little bit of comic relief, if I may. Just with a direct application of wisdom. There's a wonderful story. I don't know where I heard it or read it, but there's a wonderful story about a Zen master. I have no idea where it came from, actually, but about a Zen master who would start every morning by looking in the mirror and saying to the face in the mirror, "Don't be fooled today." And I think that's just a wonderful way to start the day. Don't be fooled. You know, because we do believe many things to be true that aren't true, and it gets us into trouble, and we suffer. Does this sound familiar to anyone here? You know? And this really, this idea of this kind of vigilant process of being very mindful and very aware and really seeing what's happening as a way of preventing our suffering and bringing us toward greater happiness. So some of the ways that we might not be fooled, just to keep in mind. Let's not be fooled into believing that you can avoid painful experience. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. To be born into a body means that there's going to be an alternation of pleasant and unpleasant experience cycling through our lives constantly. If we allow the pleasant to be there and enjoy it, and then allow it to pass when it passes, no suffering. If we allow the unpleasant to be there and endure it with an open and loving heart and allow it to pass when it passes, no suffering. This is what equanimity is. It's denial that keeps us in a state of avoiding pain. And a beautiful example of denial I'd like to share from one of my great spiritual teachers, actually, is Calvin. Do you know of Calvin of Hobbes? So Calvin is a pterodactyl, and he's flying through the Jurassic, and he's flying over water, and this huge monster that's like 20 times bigger than the Loch Ness Monster, with big teeth, comes roaring up out of the water and yells, "Calvin, pay attention." And the pterodactyl goes, "Yeah!" And then all of a sudden, Calvin is sitting at his desk with his eyes wide open and his hair blown back, and Miss Wormwood is leaning over him and saying, "We're studying geography. What state do you live in?" And he looks up and says, "Denial." And Miss Wormwood says, "Sigh, I don't suppose I can argue with that." And then the pterodactyl flies off. And then Calvin is walking along with Hobbes, and he says, "I say a day without denial is a day you've got to face." "From now on, I'm not going to think about anything that's unpleasant." And Hobbes says to him, "Isn't that a pretty self-deceiving way to go through life?" And Calvin looks out at us, and then he says, "I'm not going to think about that." Let's not be fooled, and this has to do with the law of karma, into believing that our actions don't count. Have you ever had the experience of about to do something unskillful and you say to yourself, "No one will know about it"? You know, there's a wonderful Jataka tale, the tale of the Buddha's earlier lives, when he was basically in training to doing his homework to become a Buddha. And it's actually a very patriarchal tale, so I'd like to just sort of switch the genders around, if you don't mind. It'll work just as well. So at one point there was a queen who announced that she would give away her son in marriage to any woman who could bring to her something that they had stolen that nobody knew about. And all these women appeared, you know, with precious jewels and horses and all these wonderful things that they had stolen, and they said nobody knew about it. And the queen said, "No, no." And then finally someone appeared and said, "It's not possible. It's not possible for me to steal something that no one would know about, because I would know about it. And would affect my consciousness, it would affect my conscience. It would condition me to steal again. And so it's really impossible." And of course the queen said, "Okay, you're the one," and gave her son in marriage, and they all lived happily ever after. But that's a really good story. It's a wonderful story. The law of karma, the Buddha said that no one is exempt from karma, not even a Buddha. And so what we do really matters. Every word, every action, every bit of work that we do counts. And it's really important to remember that and to hold a kind of integrity around our actions, so that we actually come out of our lives feeling great self-respect. It's important not to be fooled into believing that the sources of our happiness and suffering are outside ourselves. You know, this is a really key thing in terms of our liberation. We believe, you know, whatever. If I only was with that person, I would be happy. If I only had that car, I would be happy. If I only had that job, if I only had that home, if I only had that set of golf clubs, you know, whatever, I will be happy. And it just doesn't work that way. You get all those things, and are you happy? Really, the source of our happiness comes from the way we actually relate to our experience. It's not what happens to us, over which we have very little control. It's the skill of relating to what happens to us that is our liberation. Again, by not grasping after what is pleasant and not resisting what is unpleasant. We learn that skillful relationship until we develop, as one of my teachers, the wonderful teacher Upandita Sayadaw, said, we do this practice not so much to experience nirvana, which seems way out there, but to develop a heart that is ready for anything. And if you can imagine anything, what is the thing you fear most in your life? And imagine having a heart that's ready for it, that can respond to it, that will relate to it skillfully. the source of our happiness comes from our relating to what happens and not from anything external to ourselves. It's important for us not to be fooled into believing that our thoughts are real. You know, one of my teachers, Anagarika Munindra, used to say, the thought of your mother is not your mother. But how many times have we made the thought of our mother into our mother? You know? The judging thoughts. I have a friend, a sage friend, who she goes around the country leading workshops on healing the inner judge. You know, and she gets big turnouts. You know, is it possible not to believe the judging thoughts? Shaming thoughts are never accurate. And so to be able to turn toward the judging thoughts, judging ourselves or judging others, or shame toward ourselves or shaming others, to see those thoughts and simply to turn to them and in a friendly way say, I choose not to believe you. And in that moment of withdrawing our credence from those thoughts, they dissolve. They no longer have power over us. They only have power, these unwholesome patterns in our lives, only have power because we identify with them and believe them. In the moment we say, I choose not to believe you, gone. Thoughts of the future and thoughts of the past. It's only by being present that we're really liberated. The future does not exist. There's no guarantee that any of us will be alive tomorrow morning. You know, we can assume that we will be, but there's no guarantee, actually, because our death is certain and the time of our death is uncertain. So projecting our minds too much into the future, although rational planning is fine, you know, we need to plan our lives, but obsessing with the future is taking ourselves out of the present, and it's only in the present that liberation happens. Or too much obsession with the past. The past doesn't exist. It is a construct of memory, period. So here's Calvin taking a test. The question in the test is, what important event took place on December 16th, 1773? And Calvin's response, he's writing his response, I do not believe in linear time. There is no past and future. All is one, and existence in the temporal sense is illusory. The question, therefore, is meaningless and impossible to answer. And then he looks over at us very self-satisfied and says, when in doubt, deny all terms and definitions. So, the wisdom. And finally, not to be fooled into believing that things are permanent. We believe that things are continuous, that we somehow, in some primitive level of our minds, we believe we're going to live forever and that our loved ones are going to live forever. We just have this sense of stability and permanence that simply doesn't exist. Here's Calvin again. Calvin and Hobbes are walking through the snow. Hobbes says, are you making any resolutions for the new year? And Calvin says, nope, I want everything to stay the same as it was this year. Everything? Right. This year was lousy, but at least it's familiar. I hate change. It's too disruptive. When things are different, you have to think about the change and deal with it. I like things that stay the same so I can take everything for granted. Besides, things keep changing for the worse. The longer I live, the more complicated everything gets. He's 6 years old. I say, let's stop here before life gets any harder. From now on, no more change. And they're sort of looking around, and finally he says, I'm bored, let's do something different. And I'd like to end briefly with something about change, and really about opening to impermanence. One of the things I get to do as a teacher of Buddhism is to marry people, which I love doing. And I was invited earlier this year to marry some friends, and And I wasn't able to be there. I was going to be somewhere else. And so I wasn't able to do it. And they said, well, will you write something that we can read in the ceremony so that at least you'll be present in that way? And I sat down to write something, and I just couldn't help it. What I wanted to write about was impermanence. And so I wrote this thing, and I sent it to them, and I said, you don't have to use it. I said, a reminder of impermanence at a wedding is about as welcome as a fart in church. And I said, so it's okay if you don't use it. And they very graciously wrote back and said, this is just the element that was missing. So here's my blessing to them, actually. Here's my wish for you in your marriage. May you take refuge in each other as a strong sangha of two. Elie Wiesel wrote, if to be free is the most important goal of all, then to help someone to be or become free must be the most sublime and rewarding of human endeavors. I wish you deep, sustaining love for each other, but as rare as authentic love is, helping someone to be or become free is even rarer. If you make such mutual help the organizing principle of your life together, then authentic love and all other goodness will flow and purify between you as a natural result. The final exam of your helping each other to be or become free is likely to be losing each other. As surely as this wedding joins you, death or estrangement will part you. I hope that you will never take for granted what can never be taken for granted. If you know in your hearts every day that you will lose each other, then you can cut away attachment with the fierce courage of the fox that chews off its own leg to free itself from the trap. If you know for certain this approaching loss, perhaps every day you can thank each other for the invaluable gift of that day together. Perhaps this knowing will help you to live gratefully and urgently together in the present moment. And perhaps dwelling deeply in the present will even allow you to see that separation is only illusion, that no loss is possible, and that you are bringing each other home. So, wisdom, teaching us that all things are impermanent, that all things are unsatisfactory because they're impermanent, that all things are not self. It brings tremendous happiness, and it also moves us through a very difficult transit because it destroys the world we know. It deconstructs our understanding of the world in order for a new understanding to arise. So may we all make that transit. May we all enjoy the joys, the tremendous happiness of wisdom, and to go through the pain that often wisdom causes us, and to come to the unassailable happiness of hearts that are free from greed and hatred and delusion. Thank you.